Welcome to Shorewords, the ASPN podcast of coastal literature, the factual and fictional accounts that transport us toward the shore. I'm Leslie Ewing, the host of Shorewords, and in each episode, I talk with authors about their coastal writing and with coastal leaders about the tales and stories that inspired their chosen paths. Today, it's my great pleasure to talk with Rachel Taylor, one of the people who helped work on, conceive, and bring to fruition the book Water Worlds, The Protection of Our Blue Planet from Glaciers to Deep Sea. But before I talk with Rachel about this amazing, gorgeous, fascinating book, I'd like to take a moment to hear from the sponsors who make these podcasts possible.
Support for the American Shoreline Podcast Network and Coastal News Today comes from Geodynamics, an NV5 company. Geodynamics' team of specialists provide accurate surveys of complex coastal environments around the world using the latest technology in marine geology, coastal science, and remote sensing. With customized vessels and sensor configurations, Geodynamics delivers meticulous data products to answer their clients' toughest questions. Visit nv5geospatial.com or geodynamicsgroup.com to learn more about Geodynamics and their solutions that improve lives. And from the Coastal Zone Foundation. The Certified Coastal Practitioner Program from the Coastal Zone Foundation offers courses covering 11 different subject areas, including coastal engineering, ecology, geology, project management, and more. The CCP program emphasizes a multidisciplinary approach to coastal zone management, setting you apart from the competition and demonstrating your commitment to best practices and a code of ethics in your field. With modules available online or as live short courses, the CCP program is accessible to coastal professionals at all stages of their careers. Learn more at coastalzonefoundation.org. And don't forget, subscribe to the CNT Daily Blast newsletter for the latest news and updates from around the American shoreline. Want to support our work? Learn more about sponsorship packages at coastalnewstoday.com/advertising.
Rachel, we talked before this podcast about Water Worlds, the cast of characters who helped create it, and what you considered the long time frame, almost a year, from start to finish for this book. So for your listeners who've not yet read the book, could you explain why it came to be and all the people who helped with it?
Yeah, sure. So this project really began, I think it was 2019, and it was conversations between two companies. So Benevento, which is part of the Red Bull Media House, and a small publisher called Startup Guide, who work in sort of impact entrepreneurship space, publishing sort of guides and whatnot to help entrepreneurs in different ecosystems around the world. And the idea kind of came about that this was quite like a timely sort of, you know, with what's going on with lots of sort of ecological and climate crises, and to put a book out about water. And I had already been working with Startup Guide on sort of another project, and they asked me if I would like to be involved and head up this project, basically. And sort of the initial idea was very loose, and it was to raise water literacy in sort of an audience of mostly focused sort of European and North American, but to kind of explore the facets of what water literacy can mean, particularly in the times that we find ourselves now. So I came on board. I am well positioned to do this kind of work based on my background. So I ran and was the editor of a magazine called Another Escape for 8 years. And that was really focused on the intersection between outdoor lifestyle, environmental stewardship, and regenerative living, and took this kind of approach of welcoming people into these quite immersive story worlds to make them feel connected with the living world around them so that they would feel inspired to become environmental stewards. And that was sort of an approach that we wanted to bring into to this book as well. We felt it was quite important when talking about like water conservation issues in this type of book to think about like that storytelling experience and how you kind of create or are able to create this kind of felt experience of being in touch with water whilst actually going through the pages. So yeah, so that's sort of how the project came about and how I came to be involved with it.
Great. And I think your background in journalism and magazines and periodicals is very clear because it's got each chapter is almost a special issue of a periodical covering glaciers from some of the science of them, terminology, lore, and the fate of them and the science with them. Likewise with wetlands or with forest water areas. And it's a great dive into each of those different water systems. I really enjoyed reading it. And it's not, as I mentioned, I think to you earlier, it's not the classic book where you go from page one to page 347 and you just keep reading straight through. Although you can, and for looking at the photographs, that's certainly a wonderful thing to do. But it also is, you just sort of go, I want to read about coral reefs today. And so you start in there. Was that part of the intent to have it be like a hopscotch book?
Yeah, I think the format had always been, it was always going to be this coffee table book. It was always intended to be this like beautiful artifact that people could keep in their homes and would inspire conversations. And I think that format naturally lends to this kind of reading experience of it being sort of less linear from front to back, but gives people the opportunity to dip in different ways as well. So you can go into the long form reading if that's, you know, what you bring to the book at that time, or you can just immerse yourself in the visuals and sort of kind of dive into these small like breakout boxes where you have maybe scientific information, or maybe it's dealing with a more like philosophical approach to water connection and water environments and how people relate to them. So it was definitely, you know, purposely intended to kind of be like that, so you could jump in with whatever you were bringing to it. And I think, you know, the way that we, when we were planning it out, we were thinking about, okay, so we want this really like beautiful, diverse breadth of water environments to be represented. I mean, we could never be exhaustive in that, but we kind of wanted to be as, you know, as diverse as possible. And, but we were kind of thinking a lot about, you know, how do people connect with those environments? And the people became sort of a very strong aspect. And that's when we decided that each chapter would have a protagonist, basically. And the idea would be that we would see that environment through their lens with their knowledge and understanding. And, you know, also that we had the breadth of different people there as well, in terms of, you know, what they, how they relate to water in terms of a cultural sense or spiritual sense, but also in terms of the work that they're doing as well in sort of the conservation space or environmental space. So we were really trying to kind of pack in a lot, but in a gentle and soft way. And that sort of was part of the design of that storytelling experience as well, is making sure that it doesn't feel too overloaded, but it has, you know, it tries to get in a lot.
Well, there is a lot in the book for sure. I mean, it weighs in at almost 2 kilos, so there's a lot there. And as you said, the photographs are amazing. It took me several go-throughs to realize that there weren't captions on the photographs. There weren't explanations if you are looking at blah, 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 blah. Why did you do that?
I think on some of them there are. I think we chose which we felt should be captioned and not. I don't know if there was like so much intention of the reason why that, but other than like we wanted, when you're designing how text and image works on a printed page, it's quite an interesting sort of design and formatting that goes on there. And I think sometimes, like, we've already got lots of things going on in terms of, like, there's the breakout boxes, there's a piece of information here, you've got the main body of text. So sometimes it was important to have kind of this stillness in just like one big image on a page. And that was also something that the publisher and the publishing lead, Stefan, really wanted, was is that you need to keep this balance between like how the images are presented and also how the text works with those images and vice versa, basically.
I do like the way most of the photograph, I guess the term is bleed off the page, so that they are the whole thing. They're not bounded. They're not smaller at all. It makes for a very compelling visual image.
Yeah, for sure, for sure.
And also, while you've identified that your audience is mostly European, North American, most of your featured protectors, water stewards, water tenders, are outside of that part of the world. Was that intentional, or did you just find that there was more compelling stories when you go to Kenya and different places to talk about water there?
I think it was because we wanted to take quite a global approach to the book. I think it would be based on the markets that this book would naturally be distributed and marketed in. I think it would be quite an easy thing to slip into like quite a Eurocentric way of looking at the world, whereas water conservation, you know, it's quite a place specific thing, you know, and people are dealing with water conservation issues and challenges differently in different parts of the world. We've also sort of it within the frame of different knowledge systems as well. So I don't think there was no intent to not represent certain places. In fact, we actually intentionally were sort of going, okay, well, we want each continent to be represented here. And I believe there's two stories in North America and also two stories in Europe as well. So, yeah, I feel like we had that there. But probably also what you're hinting at here is that there's quite a lot of traditional knowledge also that's kind of weaved through the book through different chapters as well. And I think that became part of that sort of like move to kind of not just allow ourselves to just fall into kind of a Eurocentric way of looking at conservation issues, and to kind of bring in these elements of ethical storytelling, which is something that sort of I carried over from projects that I've done in the past, of thinking about, okay, so the stories that we tell, they definitely matter. They have the ability to uphold, but also dismantle some power dynamics that we're feeling sort of at a global level. And how do we, you know, make sure that people have agency and also voice in conservation spaces. And it's not just about sort of representation of that. It's also about sort of including those stories and narratives and points of view and different ways of knowing and seeing and being in the world, and sort of allowing that to sort of intersect with Western science, as it were, or modern science, if you want to call it that, which definitely a lot of the organizations that supported this book are sort of doing in their work as well. There's this sort of integration of sort of traditional ecological knowledge, but also with modern science, and sort of trying to leverage the best out of both, whilst also honoring sort of the land and the waters of which they're working with.
One of the things I found very uplifting, in fact, was not so much the coastal writing, but about the experiences in Kenya, where they've got so much desertification, dry lands that are just too dry to support vegetation, and the small, almost community, well, definitely community-led, small efforts to bring back grasslands, and the significance of having started these donut things. I think they're called Banu, but that people could make a huge difference. And that was so nice, because often in the climate world and the water world, the news is so dire at times, And it seems so vast that you kind of feel, at least I do, that there's not much I could do. And to read stories about individuals being so effective and taking control over problems that they see was a great part of the book. I thought Kenya was a great story. The work going on in Finland. My God, I didn't know anything about Finland. So talk about both. Talk about either. Talk about your other favorite place to go.
Yeah. Well, actually, I'm just going to go. So you were saying that really interesting thing about like today, you know, the news cycles and the stories that we hear, it is very sort of doom and gloom, particularly around sort of climate and ecological issues. And that was definitely something that we felt in the production of the book for sure. But I think also, you know, also as you're pointing out, there's this hopefulness as well that comes through when you actually sort of look at the work that's being done. And it almost kind of takes this like zooming in, zooming out, like looking at it at a planetary level of, you know, of course, we're facing these crises. But also if you kind of like draw in the focus, there are people all around the world who are on like working on the front lines for conservation, regeneration, preservation. And often they're quite low-fi efforts as well. So the Kenya chapter that you spoke about, we worked with an organization called Just Dig It, which is actually a Dutch organization, but they work mostly on the African continent to sort of empower local people to do regeneration, like land regeneration and reforestation projects. And, you know, it's just simple technologies that are being used of carving what they call buns. So it's sort of like a crescent moon shape into the land. And the way then when it rains, it's sort of it's a water capture system where then sort of the seeds that are asleep in the soil then kind of germinate. And then you have an ongoing effect where it catches water and is able to regreen huge areas of space. And I think, like you were saying, those sorts of projects are very, very hopeful and often don't make it into news stories because it's not really very sexy, people digging up these little crescent moons of Earth. But I do think these are quite important stories to be telling as well. And I think sort of that was that experience of holding sort of grief in a way as we were making this book, but also the hopefulness was like quite an interesting thing. I find this a lot in my work as well, is it almost you need to not hold it in contention so much, but like allow the two to kind of come together and to, you know, not let the pain of what we're going through at a planetary level be to overshadow like what's actually happening.
And the story in Finland I found most compelling because you've got someone who comes as he's not Sami, but he's traditional Finn. So he has a very strong tie to the country. As I said, I knew very little about Finland until I read that and then wanted to learn much more. But he also comes as a scientist, as a geographer, and discovered that part of the traditional knowledge, even of the names of the lakes, told what they had been historically, where having that traditional ecological knowledge became a touchstone for people to go back and say, well, there were trout here. We need to restore that. How do you find the people who are your key points for these different parts of the world?
Yeah, that was a big effort on research. We worked with sort of a group of writers as well, and they Jen was the one, Jennifer Turney was the one who wrote that chapter, and she already was in touch with Taro. So she'd worked with him in the past on writing projects, and she actually came to us and was like, I think he would be a wonderful addition to the book. And actually, you know, the more I read about him, the more I was like, yes, 100%, definitely. And that traditional Finn or Finnish, you know, part of him. So you said about not being Sami. So he's not Sami. Sami are the what would be considered the only indigenous peoples in Europe or of Europe, but there's definitely still traditional cultures across Europe that hold traditional knowledge within their language systems and place names and even just ways of being. So the way that they're fishing and living off the land and in relationship with the land. And that's not just in Finland or in Scandinavia, but you'll find that also in lots of other places across across Europe, but also obviously across the world. And I think he, you know, Taro makes this point of sort of when we listen and when we investigate into those old ways or ancient names of places and things, we can actually learn a lot. And I think there was a project that he was working on with some scientists from I can't remember what university, but you know, allowing those scientists to actually learn from sort of old knowledge to inform the work that they were doing in terms of like understanding, they were doing fish studies, if I remember rightly, and it gave them sort of better baselines to work from. So that was, yeah, it's really interesting, actually.
Definitely. And then the way they were able to change the whole mining process, mining of peat, one of the most dirty fuels in the world, and stopping its expanse, I guess, because of the water quality degradation that was happening and the fish die-offs, that just even thinking about it through modern knowledge, understanding of chemistry, the acidity within a peat bog is such that, of course, it's going to be very harmful, if not lethal, to fish species when you have these great releases of that water. But for them to have to prove it just boggled my mind. But having the tenacity to do that, which kind of moves me over to the Bay of Bengal. With the Delta areas and all the great work that's going on there. But one of the quotes in the book just struck me as being so poignant for much of what the main book is talking about, of these small projects, indigenous knowledge, ecological understanding that's driving things. And just, no matter how many good policies or laws or how much money you have, a species is not going to be saved if the people, the real stakeholders with a connection to the species and their ecosystems, if they do not have the capacity to decide what something, they do not have the capacity to decide that something should be done. And so much of your book is driven by the actions of the people who see something needs to be done. I think that's one of the few times I noticed a reference to laws and policies and such. How much of this was driven by the idea that community action, community grassroots efforts or grass planting efforts was the spur for this part of your treatment for water? There's certainly need for laws, but was that an intentional thing to leave out the policymakers, the laws, the councils, and all the work that goes on there that's also important at certain levels?
Yeah, so, well, first off, I think that naturally started to come through in the content because I was leading the editorial. And I guess I've also recently completed a course called the Regenerative Practitioner Series. So it's run by the Regenesis Institute, and it's very much looking at place-based potential, how you empower people to become agents of change in place. Empower might be the wrong word, but it's about sort of recognizing that people in place are often the best stewards of place because they have the knowledge of it. They rely on these places in terms of, you know, obviously we're all part of global systems and whatnot, but, you know, at least traditionally, we have to know how to live sustainably in place, otherwise we exhaust the resources in which we live off of. So I think definitely that has guided some of my personal thinking and then probably has kind of spilled over into the book. And I think, you know, policies and like the kind of whole political level. We didn't want to go too heavily into that because actually I think this work lives beyond that sphere, and policies change, you know, they can be quite fleeting. And I know that sort of, you know, there's broader like sustainability goals that collectively we're working towards, but I think we wanted to focus a bit more on sort of what's actually happening on the ground and like what's moving the needle really in terms of the direction we're going in for conservation issues.
Yeah. As the book got into Alaska and the area there, there's the talk about kelp, the kelp road that, again, something I'd never heard but want to investigate more, is that the travel from to across the Bering Sea or through that area to inhabit North America happened much earlier than many people have thought, and that it was through the kelp, through that resource, that people traveled and were able to come down from the Bering Sea and come along the Pacific coast on North America. That was really intriguing to me.
Yeah. So I actually only learned that in the making of this book. So I think it was actually Jennifer Turney who worked on that chapter as well, the chapter on June Lankard up in Alaska. And I, as a team, we spent so long researching that, just like that very small little piece of information probably had like at least a day's worth of research behind it. And it's one of the theories that's out there in terms of that sort of like movement and migration of people down the coastline of the west coast of the Americas, basically. And I equally found it very interesting.
Yeah. There's just so much still to be learned, and the worry that so much of it's going to be lost has already been lost is one of the other parts that come through this book. Of you wonder if the book had been done 100 years ago or even 50 years ago, what other opportunities would there have been to find ways to be more protective of the ocean? But and I love that you include surfing. I'm not a surfer myself, but I know many people who do, some very good friends, and so much of what you had talked about already had been sort of livelihood, water, ecosystems, and then getting into the joy of water that surfing, that body surfing, that being on the water brings. And because you found someone who was Maori, to be able to then explain it through the cultural rising up of surfing in that community was wonderful. I love his tattoos too, that are part of the photographs, but it brought a nice fun part to the book of that surfing. And I'm glad it was included. Was there any controversy over talking about surfing as part of the water planet?
No, I don't think so. I think, very early on, as I was saying sort of at the beginning, we really wanted that joyfulness to come through. I think we spoke about hope, but I think like awe and wonder and this felt experience. And it is, you know, surfing is something that millions of people do today as a way to actually feel in touch, like feel immersed in water, in a way that's probably quite innate, because, you know, if you think about sort of the memory that maybe lives inside of us in our genes and DNA, like we, you know, come from water at, you know, millions of years ago. But actually, you know, there was a book, I think it was called The Blue Mind by, I can't remember his name, looked at studies around sort of like how we are actually drawn to water, how it affects us. And that's, you know, there's something about that that's like very tantalizing, I think. And yeah, we wanted to make sure that sort of lived through the pages as well, that there was this felt connection to water. And surfing is a way that I think a lot of people can connect directly to water, be it through the pages of a book or in actuality. We've kind of moved through talking about the chapters, but actually it might be interesting to talk a little bit about how we structured the book in terms of the navigation and the way that we sort of flowed through those chapters.
Definitely, please do that.
So sort of in the title of the book, it's From Glacier to Deep Ocean, and actually that was, purposeful in terms of thinking about like this flow downstream. So the environments that we explore, we actually in the book's navigation move from glacier through to upstream, downstream, lakes, drylands, wetlands, rainforest, delta, coast, sea, coral reef, and ocean. And sort of part of the design of that, or at least the thinking, was that we wanted to represent the water cycle, and we wanted to show sort of how interconnected these different environments are, and how, it's often easy, I think, to think of water issues in maybe sort of quite fragmented ways, in sort of smaller systems, but it all plays into these larger systems. The way that sort of groundwater affects lakes, or what happens to upstream ecosystems impacts delta and sea ecosystems, so I think it was purposely kind of to try and get the reader to feel into this flow, this movement of water, and to feel sort of water as sort of a living sort of thing, but also to kind of show that sort of like holistic and systemic perspective and at like a planetary level as well. So hopefully we succeeded in that, even if it's subtle.
No, I think you did that very well. And even just the subtle part of putting the different elevations for the different ecotones, ecosystems, water systems you were working with. I did this past weekend go to an observatory to look at the stars, and our great viewing evening in terms of light pollution was interrupted by so many clouds. And it made me realize that you could have started there. You could have gone up into that stratosphere and talked about all the water that is up in the clouds and how it's part of the whole water system. But that's for another book, perhaps.
I think within the glacier and also the rainforest, when we were talking about sort of like the movement of water through the sort of atmosphere, and in the glacier one, we're talking about the movement of microbes within those, how actually microbes, as they move through air, water, and land, connect those sort of like terrestrial ecosystems with also the atmosphere.
Yes. So how has this book been received? Who are the audiences who've responded to the book, and what are their comments been?
Yeah, so as I understand it, the book is being received really well, and it's been sort of had high praise from press and bloggers, and particularly I think the German edition, because this book is published in both English and German, because the publisher Benevento is a German language publisher, and including Birgit Sattler, who's actually in the Glacier chapter, she made a TV appearance representing the book, and I think a lot of magazines have picked it up, particularly those that have got an environmental or sort of nature focus, have received it really well, and have commented also on the way that it's formatted, being something that's of interest to people, and felt to be quite an interesting way to deliver stories about water conservation and water ecosystems.
Yes. So how can people who are listening to this podcast find a copy of your book? Is it on Amazon?
It is on Amazon. You can also go into your favorite bookshop, basically, and ask for it. If they don't have it in store, then they should be able to order it, because it's through sort of good distribution channels. And then there's the online retailers as well, so Amazon's and whatnot.
Wonderful. And Red Bull, that's the drink company, but this is their media presence that is part of the development of the book?
Yes, exactly. So probably known widely for their energy drink, but also Red Bull, particularly in Europe and in the German-speaking world, have like a really strong media presence. They have like TV shows and magazine, and they have like a whole book publishing arm. And yeah, so there's a lot to the media house.
Learn something new every morning, every day. That's great. What are the future projects for you? What do you have next, or what do you have ongoing right now?
So I'm currently sort of working with a few magazines as a writer. So I also write in the space of regeneration and thinking about how we can bring human cultures into alignment with the living world. I sort of starting to cook up a new book idea. Looking at sort of a broader kind of idea around regeneration. What else have I got going on? I've been working with some organizations this year, Flourishing Diversity being one, School of Systems Change being another. And sort of it's interesting because you start to see the intersections of all of this work and how you're affected by different projects that you work on and bring different bits into all of them. So it's actually, it's always a learning process, every project that you do. So,
So in the book, you mentioned the donut phenomena is part of the regenerative learning. What is that? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Donut economics, I think you might be speaking about. Yeah, so donut economics I think there's a few people who work in sort of regenerative economics and within that space, but it was Kate Raworth who wrote a book called Donut Economics. And she basically is talking about how we can change our economic systems and also the thinking that goes behind them so that we start to bring those into the sort of periphery into the parameters of our planetary systems. So at the moment, sort of our economics are based on sort of progress and growth and but a lot of that can't sit within like finite systems. So if we sort of continue to extract resources, then I feel like we know the story there. That sort of did get a mention in one of the chapters. I can't remember which one it was. I think it was the kelp chapter, coast. So that is one. Regenerative economics is one sort of part of broader regeneration movement that is looking to bring humans back into alignment with living systems, basically.
Right. It caused me to think about a professor I had years ago who talked about the soda pop principles, that whenever anyone goes to the beach, they will usually buy a soda pop or they'll buy perhaps a donut, they'll buy something. There's always that added economic value of having people go to a beach in addition to the value that they get from the experience of being there. There's the sales opportunities that come with it. And that was what he would always call the soda pop phenomenon. And so I immediately thought of that when you mentioned donut economics, that of course people are going to buy donuts when they go different places as well, but different idea. Definitely understand that. So talking about going to beaches, do you have a favorite beach or a favorite type of shoreline that you like to go to?
I do, mostly because I live very, very, very close to a beach. So I'm actually based on the Atlantic coast of Portugal, so not too far from Lisbon, and not too far from Ericeira, which is quite a surfing mecca as well. And so I've got a local beach which I love to go to, and it's really, really beautiful. It's west coast, so get the great sunsets as well.
Is it a Four Season beach? You can go there all year without having to put on your ski gear to get there and survive the cold weather, is it?
It's definitely coats, hats and whatnot in the winter.
Okay.
But I mean, you can go there for sure. And when the sun's out, you know, it's still beautiful. In the winter, it can still be around 15 degrees here, so Celsius.
Celsius, yes. Yes. And how about favorite writers, coastal writers, perhaps? And obviously everyone who is in the book is a favorite writer, so maybe expand beyond that group.
So coastal writers specifically, I mean, in general, so at the moment what I'm reading is Ways of Being by James Bridle, which is a super interesting book. It looks at sort of a intelligences of humans, of animals, of plants, but also kind of looks at it through like a developing AI lens. Not quite coastal, but interesting nonetheless. So Tyson Yunkaporta, I'm reading his book Sand Talk at the moment, which is really interesting. It looks at he's a Australian Aboriginal scholar, and so he's looking at sort of what would if we brought like sort of a Indigenous lens to the big issues that we're facing, how could that maybe help us at a global level. So that probably is quite fitting to some of the content in the book as well, actually. I'm trying to think if there's water specific.
It's part of everything, but it's also, it intrigues me that the books that most people who are writers that they're reading are so different from the top 10 on the New York Times bestseller list, and always sort of an intrigue into other areas to look into and opportunities to explore a little bit more into the unknown literature that is often so wonderful.
I rarely have to go looking for, as in books land with me in terms of like get so many recommendations from people, and the books I read, I tend to go off recommendations. When someone goes, I think you'll really enjoy this, I go, okay, I will go pick that up.
Give it a try. Definitely.
Yeah, exactly.
Any last words you'd like to impart for the Shore Words listeners?
I just hope that people, get to enjoy it, get to at least, have a flick through, and I hope that that sort of labor of love comes through as well. There was a lot of people and organizations that supported this project, and without them it definitely wouldn't be what it is. And I think I also have like immense gratitude for the team that brought it into being, both at Startup Guide for all the freelancers, and also at Beneventu as well. So it was a huge effort on lots of people's part, and I think what we've created at the end of it is this really beautiful piece of work, this body of work that hopefully people can live on people's coffee tables and bookshelves for times to come. And not to take kind of a grim look at it, but even in however many decades, hopefully it will sort of still stand as something that's sort of like this beautiful honouring of the world as it is right now, even if that isn't what it will be in the future.
Yes. And along with that, the photography is incredible, which means the photographers you found to do the work along with the writing, they were phenomenal. So many kudos to them as well. And I know they were part of your list of thanks and gratitude.
Yeah, for sure. And a lot of them were local as well, because we felt it was quite important to have a local lens on what we were talking about.
Camera lens on things. Clever. Wonderful way to end. So thank you everyone for listening to this episode of Shore Words with Rachel Taylor, talking about the book Water Worlds, The Protection of Our Blue Planet from Glacier to Deep Sea. I hope you've enjoyed it, find it fascinating. Hope you can go out and find the book and read it and enjoy it. And that it both, having listened to this, it's now encouraging you to look differently at your favorite source of water, water spot. And till next time, enjoy the coast and your view of the shore.